Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Delaware's only law school now stands on its own and has a new dean to guide it.
It was very attractive to me that the Widener Delaware Law School was splitting off from the school in Harrisburg and would be the only law school here in Delaware. It's a small legal community, but a very influential legal community.
Widener Delaware Law School Dean Rod Smola joins us to discuss the school's future. Rob Kelly has always been drawn to art and science in equal measure.
Before fifth grade, I remember my mother said I made like a little wastebasket out of paper completely. You step on the pedal and the lid lifted, and I made little jack-in-the-box things. And so I would make all these little things that moved completely out of paper, tape, and scissors.
In our arts playlist, we talked to Kelly about his new paper-based sculpture exhibition. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also hit the streets with Dover's new police cadet program, examine two planned youth sports complexes coming to Delaware, and get a local perspective on NASA's Pluto flyby. The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground, is next. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Earlier this month, the First States Only Law School experienced a significant change. No longer is it Widener University Law School's Delaware campus. It's now Widener University Delaware Law School, officially separating from Widener's other campus in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and becoming its own law school. At the same time, Delaware Law welcomed its new dean, Rod Smola. Smola previously served as dean at both the University of Richmond and Washington and Lee University Schools of Law, and president of Furman University. He's also a well-known litigator who's argued before the U.S. Supreme Court, as well as an author of a variety of books, articles, and law school casebooks. Smola joined us earlier this week in studio to discuss the new path Widener Delaware Law is on. You've worn many hats: litigator, author, professor, law school dean, university president. Why this particular hat, dean of Delaware Law at this particular time?
Yeah, you know, I guess there's two things to say. One is I've loved being a law school dean. I like being a lawyer, even though I enjoyed being a university president where I had a football team and a symphony. I like law students, law faculty members, and all the things you get to do as a law school dean. And it was very attractive to me that the Widener Delaware Law School was splitting off from the school in Harrisburg and would be the only law school here in Delaware. It's a small legal community, but a very influential legal community. And we're the only law school in the state. And since I've enjoyed very much being part of the civic and legal community where I've lived and looking for ways that a law school can be involved in the community around it, the justice system, and serving people more generally, it seemed ideal. And it's a really nice part of the country that I like, and my family liked it. So all those things sort of combined to make it a good fit.
You mentioned liking the atmosphere of the law school. You are going to teach a class in constitutional law at Delaware Law. For you, how important is it to maintain that connection to the students in that way?
It's gigantically important. I actually taught, even when I was a university president, I taught a freshman seminar every year. As a law school dean, the two times before when I was a law school dean, I always taught every semester, and I'm looking forward to doing it here. First of all, it's symbolically important because you're saying to the students and to the faculty members, I'm a teacher too, and I'm really a teacher first. And secondly, there's no substitute for the way you get to know students for the classroom. I mean, the classroom is really the way you see them, you know, day in and day out, and interact and do the things that that help them grow as young lawyers. And selfishly, I just love teaching constitutional law. I mean, it's fascinating issues. Every day, that's stuff that's in the news, and I've spent my whole life in that world, and I would miss it if I didn't get to, have an outlet for that.
Are you a tough professor?
I'm a medium, you know, medium.
Well, you mentioned at the top the move to become a separate law school, you know, really offers Delaware Law a unique opportunity to kind of reimagine the school while still maintaining its strong foundation that it's built over a couple of decades. What do you hope this change will mean for the school going forward?
You know, I hope it's a real driver for us in terms of admissions, because we'll have our own separate identity and be able to evolve in terms of that identity. And the stronger you have your own sense of mission and purpose, the more I think people are attracted to you. It really frees us up to take the service side of being a law school, that part of the school that is focused on how you can positively contribute to society. It frees us up to do that in our hometown, if you will, mm-hmm. where we are. And I think that's enormously important. And, you know, Delaware as a state is unique in the world in terms of its influence on the law because of the influence of Delaware corporation law and also because of the history in this state of trying to practice law with a, you know, fair measure of civility. Those are two things that are really important and getting increasingly rare. And so thinking of building the school largely around those sorts of identity points, that nowhere in the world can you understand the importance of business law quite like you can here. So that is really useful to the school. And the notion that it's really critical to graduate people who have imbued in them a sense of practicing with some moral integrity, strong sense of ethics, and a sense of professionalism and civility is important. So I see those as really positive values that the school have more freedom to emphasize now that it's on its own.
And a lot of that, I guess, goes to the mission that you talked a little bit about earlier. What, in your mind, if you had to boil down the mission of Delaware law as it goes forward, what is it to you?
You know, in some ways, it's not that different from a lot of law schools. Mm-hmm. I mean, our first mission is to take people that want to enter the legal profession and give them the grounding that they need intellectually, but more importantly, their development as professionals, their ability to counsel people, solve problems, be good advocates in an ethical way and an honorable way. So that's our first mission. Second is contributing to the world of ideas. We have professors that are researching, writing about, helping with legislation, dealing with reform issues on the whole vast expanse of legal issues that concern our society. And so that's an important part of the mission. And then finally, something you've heard me talk about a lot, serving the community in mm-hmm. one way or another, serving underserved populations, contributing, you know, to committees and task forces and all the sorts of things that professors and students can do to help the society around them.
We've talked a lot about these kind of philosophical, mission-oriented things so far. For the average student, on a day-to-day basis, what does this change mean to them?
It may not be that visible mm-hmm. to them. The professors will still be the same professors. Right. We're not changing the subject matter of the curriculum. There is, I think, an excitement in the building. There's a buzz. There's a pride. So there's maybe that intangible kind of spirit de corps quality that's important. But I think that day in and day out, they'll be reading the same cases they would have read. They'll be writing the same assignments they would have done. They'll be taking the same tests, and they'll be looking for the same jobs. And so it may not matter. Now, I'll add one thing where it could help.
Sure.
You know, one of our hopes is that this change also will really help us strengthen our connections to our alumni and strengthen our ability to help our students get jobs. And that's always important to them. And so that'll be a work in progress. But I hope that part of the strength of this new identity will help there. And that will matter a lot to our average students.
And that is a challenge in the law school area these days, is getting students jobs.
It is. Actually, the Delaware Law School has done remarkably well. And despite the economic downturn and despite the softness in legal jobs generally in the United States, the school has held its own and done quite well. The change in the legal market has not been the same throughout the market. Mm-hmm. It's actually been a change that hit the more upscale, high-end, big corporate law part of society more than it affected the kind of middle class, providing legal services to families, small businesses. That side hasn't really diminished much and probably won't. And that's where a lot of our law students historically have gone. So we're doing fine there, but it's really important. It's a sort of promise we're making to the students. They're coming because they want careers, and it's really important for us to both prepare them for those and to do everything we can to help them find the not only jobs that pay well for them, but that are meaningful for them and where they're fulfilled and they like the thing that they're doing.
You alluded to some of the strengths of the school. I mean, you have some terrific high profile programs. Obviously, the business and corporate law, also environmental law, family health law. How do you make the most of these programs going forward and building the Delaware Law, both the brand and I guess and actually, you know, as you mentioned, kind of the service to both the students and the community.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. That's one of the things I'm trying to figure out right now. Mm-hmm. Been on the job for 2 or 3 weeks, and so I'm on a tour of the school and learning about all of our specialty programs, learning the ones that have upside potential that could do more if we invested in them, mm-hmm. And then looking for the resources to do that. So everything you've mentioned is enormously important. We're very proud of all those programs. And one of the things I'm right now in the process of doing are meeting the leaders of those and understanding, what their aspirations are to make them stronger and then trying to figure out a way to get that job done.
At first blush, do you see a lot of potential to expand or build them?
Huge. There's no question with regard to those programs. And also, the Delaware Law School does a lot of educational programs outside of simply educating lawyers. We mm-hmm. have a very strong paralegal program. We have a program for legal nurses. We have programs for various kinds of graduate students, including international students. We have programs for those who want to get a career as translators in the judicial system for people that don't speak English. And those have huge upside potential for people that they don't see themselves as lawyers. They don't see themselves going to law school for 3 years. But they do see themselves either getting their undergraduate degree with a specialty like one of these mm-hmm. or adding another year or two and finding markets that have a lot of potential. And we think there's other areas like that, akin to that, that wouldn't be a traditional legal degree but would be connected to the legal system in some way, where there's real markets and needs in society that we could deliver well. And so that's something that I'm really excited about and see a lot of upside potential to.
As you've done this tour in your first couple of weeks, is there anything at first blush that has struck you immediately as something that you didn't necessarily know that, from the process of applying for the job and learning about the school through that process?
You know, what I just described is really one of them.
Okay.
And I was astonished both at how many students we've educated in those various areas, our paralegal program and related things like that, and I was astonished at my sense of the upside potential of that if we wanted to enter that more. I guess the other thing I'll tell you is I've really been struck by how much the alumni love the school and how many of them there are in this state. Of course, they're all over, and a lot of them are in Pennsylvania and New Jersey as well, but there's a real loyalty there that's palpable. And then within the Delaware legal community, where there are a lot of lawyers and a lot of judges because of its importance to the state, I'm really pleased with how much they love the law school, even if it wasn't where they went to law school. But they see it as important to have a strong law school in the state, and they've been enormously hospitable to me and welcoming me here, and I'm happy to be part of that community too.
I'm sure this is probably a little bit too early to answer, but I'll ask it anyway. Is there a sense in your mind that there's room for physical expansion of the campus?
Yeah, I doubt it. We have an expansive and beautiful campus right now, so we're not crunched for space. Mm-hmm. But here's a different story. I definitely think there's a possibility of having programs in satellite locations, clinical programs that provide service to folks. So having a presence outside of our current campus is definitely something we'll explore. And it's too early in the game to know for sure exactly what shape that would take, but I can easily see that in a number of different parts of the state, including this part of the state.
I was going to say, man, I guess that goes to being Delaware's law school. That's the idea of being throughout the state and finding ways to move into maybe Kent and Sussex County would be a priority to kind of expand that footprint from where it is right now.
Yeah, it's really something important for me to want to explore and get a sense of what that would mean and how we would staff it and what the program would be that would be useful and helpful. But I'd love to see us do that kind of thing.
Do you see some of those other programs you talked about, the paralegal and those type of things, being perhaps entrees to that possibility?
Could be that you'd have satellite programs like that, and then it could also be things like legal clinics or extensions of our current clinics.
Sure.
But we're part of a bureaucracy. We're part of an accreditation bureaucracy. Our principal accreditor is the American Bar Association, and we have to pass their rules, not just with regard to our programs for training lawyers, but for all these other programs as well. And so they actually have rules about if you have a satellite, you know, so many miles away from your main campus, what you've got to go through in order to satisfy them as quality control. I'm sure we'd be able to do all of that. So all of this has got to be sorted out and figured out. But it's definitely, you know, the kind of thing I'm excited about exploring.
We've talked about this larger footprint. You talked about the connection to the community, the law community in Delaware. But I recall, you know, a couple weeks ago during the kind of the separation day announcement, you talked about the importance of also realizing the kind of the regional importance of the school, that it is Delaware's law school, but it also has a place within the right. region. How difficult of a balancing act is that to make sure that you have that sense of Delaware, but also understanding that for your students, there's a broader world for them to be connected to?
Well, first of all, it is a balancing act, and numbers are important. And so something like 2/3 of our students every year come from Pennsylvania. A lot of our students come from the greater Philadelphia metropolitan area. And so in terms of recruiting students and getting students jobs, that's actually where the center of gravity is, and New Jersey is second. Delaware is behind them just because of the smallness of the state population-wise. I think that in one sense, like every law school in the country, we draw students from everywhere. Right. We heavily draw from this region. Most of the law that students learn in any law school in the country is a sort of national body of law. So you could go to a California law school and 90% of what students would be learning in that law school would be exactly the same as what they're learning here. So in terms of just where we draw students from and how we educate them, this change has no impact and we'll be recruiting in those other areas just as much as we ever did. And the teaching is transferable just as much as everywhere. So I think it's more that service side and that community connection side and that identity side where the shift will be. And it doesn't mean we won't send students to do clinical work or to, in the Philadelphia area or in New Jersey if there are opportunities there. Doesn't mean I won't be there all the time visiting those lawyers and being part of that. But I think it does mean that, you know, as Tip O'Neill said, all politics is local. We can have the biggest impact right here. And so in that sense, that will be important. And one other quick thing to say.
Sure.
I think we're at almost any law school that you might go to, you'd find a similar balance. So I went to Duke Law School, and there were classmates from every state in the country that were at that law school, and from countries all over the world. But in a certain way, the things that Duke was able to do to contribute to society in a palpable way, serving underserved populations, you know, poverty law sorts of things, things that had where students had a hands-on ability to learn how to donate their time and help folks with regard to legal matters. Well, those were all in Durham, North Carolina, or the surrounding North Carolina area. They almost had to be.
Right.
And of course, there were some broader programs that did things elsewhere, but that was where it was. So the balance I've described isn't that unusual. It makes sense. But I do think that there's that special identity side that'll be connected to Delaware. That's important, and I'm going to embrace.
Our thanks to new Delaware Law Dean Rod Smola for taking time to join us this week on The Green. Next up, 2 youth sports complexes are on track to open next year in Delaware, just 40 miles apart. Can they both be successful? We take a look. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. In the next year and a half, 2 new sports complexes are set to open in Delaware just about 45 minutes apart. The Delaware Sports Complex in Middletown and Kent County's The Turf in Frederica are both hoping to support local leagues and bring in big tournaments from around the country. They're potential competitors, but as Delaware Public Media's Annie Ropeek reports, collaboration could be the key to their ultimate success.
Beside an unkempt, county-owned field next to Route 1 in Frederica, Bill Strickland of the Greater Kent Committee is hoping if he builds it, they will come.
Well, what we're looking at here is the future site of the Kent County Regional Sports Complex. What you don't see today, but will starting in October of this year when we break ground, 13 rectangular fields with principal use for the sports of soccer, lacrosse, field hockey, as well as...
The not-for-profit complex known as the Turf has been in the works for several years. The county had originally hoped to create indoor space, but pared down to make the project more cost-effective. Then they were held up by a delay to a planned overpass, which was needed for easy access off the highway. DelDOT is now expecting to build that overpass in 2017, and Strickland says they're ready to move forward.
This project will represent, based upon 10 regional tournaments, a direct economic impact to Central Delaware ranging from $25 to $30 million annually. That's on 10 tournaments. We're anticipating that we will likely see somewhere between 15 to 20. That's bringing folks here. That's really, it's rather cliche, but I think it's very true. It's about driving out-of-state license plates into the parking areas of our restaurants and hotels.
But Kent County isn't the only one with that goal. While the Turf was on hold, another player stepped onto the field, the private Delaware Sports Complex, less than 40 miles north in Middletown. Pending final town approval this summer, it's set to be built on townland outside Charles Price Memorial Park, a little quieter than off Route 1. Developer Scott Lobdell points out Amazon's warehouse and the road that leads downtown.
So there's about 100 acres over here, about 70 acres over there, and it's a multi-sport complex. We have 20 outdoor full-size fields for different types of sports, lacrosse, soccer, field hockey, rugby, football, you name it, they'll be able to play on the field.
Sounds similar to Kent County. Well, in Middletown, there's even more.
And we have two indoor buildings. The main one is 160,000 square feet with offices, party rooms. There's a full-size field inside, hard court surface that fits three basketball courts with seating. And the smaller complex, the smaller building is about 75,000 square feet. And it's sized for an aquatic center, but it could be used for other things if the aquatic center isn't marketable, I guess the term would be.
It depends when we get a build. You know, what the market bears out. You know, what do we need to fill?
That's Lobdell's business partner, Brian Ellis. They've already owned the nearby M-Town Sports Complex for a few years, but they say they knew as soon as it opened that it wasn't big enough for what Middletown was capable of bringing in.
This particular location truly couldn't be any better. Middletown is one of the largest growing zip codes in the country right now.
They started up their project after Kent County's was already in the works, but they say they have different goals. They'll have grass fields instead of turf, and they plan to run local league and club sports too, which they don't see happening in Kent County.
We don't look at it as a competition.
We don't look at it as competition.
No. They're completely different than what we are set up.
Yeah, I would say we would be competitors.
That's Bill Strickland again. He says the Turf will host more than just tournaments and that their differences will give them an edge over Middletown. They'll have fewer fields and less space, but he notes their lighted turf fields will allow them to play through poor weather and during more times of year when daylight is in shorter supply. And for one group, it's the more the merrier. That's the Delaware Sports Commission, where Chris Giacomucci is executive director.
We look at things from a macro level, so it would really be up to event organizers to decide whatever complexes meet their event needs. So, like I said, having complexes of this caliber will really be able to allow us to market the state of Delaware as a whole relative to our competitive states in other areas within the Mid-Atlantic region.
Middletown and Kent County are joining an already crowded field. There are other big facilities like Crown Sports Center outside Salisbury, Maryland, and Kirkwood Soccer in Wilmington. But Giacomucci feels there's no limit to how many events they can bring in, and neither he nor the new complex's developers are concerned about filling the space. Don Schumacher has a different take on that. He heads up the National Association of Sports Commissions, which includes Delaware's, and he worked on early feasibility studies for the Kent County complex. He says existing tournaments aren't hard up for places to go. That old Field of Dreams mantra, not necessarily true.
If you build it, they won't come unless they are incented to come.
That means the new complexes need staff with national clout and the promise of enough local amenities. He doesn't dispute that Delaware can offer that, but he says two facilities so close together will probably need to collaborate to succeed.
If they can work together from time to time, you could do some of the biggest events in the country. That's going to be hard to do because everybody is going to be trying to schedule their fields as often as they possibly can, which means it'll kind of get unwieldy unless they all kind of get together at some point and say, gee whiz, maybe we could accomplish more things together than we could apart.
Middletown's developers say they're open to that idea, and either way, Schumacher says the onus will be on Kent to stay afloat. Out-of-state events drive tourism dollars and fill more space, but Schumacher says site-specific events will be important, too.
I think they'll need as many events as they can possibly get. Kent has to keep in mind that the people that are doing these other facilities are players in soccer. I mean, especially Salisbury and Wilmington, these are people that have been in business a long time.
And he says Middletown's project puts even more pressure on Kent's publicly funded facility.
I hear people say, who cares? Don't worry about whether it makes any money or not because it's publicly funded. Well, I happen to think that matters a lot because publicly funded facilities are paid for by the taxpayers that are going to be in the area, and you don't want those taxpayers to have a disappointing experience and have a white elephant as a result of it.
Both new facilities are already working on developing their own programs. Middletown's developers have started up a league of their own, Revolution Sports, which is set to open the facility with a lacrosse tournament a year from now. And even though Kent's project got started earlier, they'll follow after that with a soccer tournament planned for Columbus Day weekend 2016. Annie Ropeek, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Annie. And there's more coming up on The Green in a moment, including a local perspective on NASA's Pluto flyby this week. That and this week's Arts Playlist and Enlighten Me are on the way after a look at the latest local news from Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green. I'm Tom Byrne. Earlier this week, NASA's New Horizons space probe reached Pluto after its 9-year, 3-billion-mile journey. After New Horizons made its flyby of Pluto Tuesday, just 7,700 miles above the dwarf planet, it began Wednesday to beam back images to Earth along with other information. Those captivating pictures are already shedding new light on our distant planetary relative, with the promise of an even better understanding as scientists examine the full range of images and data the probe sends. Earlier this week, Delaware Public Media science reporter Eli Chen spoke with University of Delaware astronomer Judy Provencial to get her first impression of the photos from New Horizons.
So, Dr. Provencial, what does it mean for you as an astronomer that we've now been able to reach the furthest planet or not planet in our solar system?
Just for the exploration of the solar system, this is a fantastic thing. I mean, this is something we have never seen before. And to me, that's just amazing that we can get a probe out there. This is 3 billion miles away. And we have sent something past there that's taken all these wonderful pictures, and that's just fantastic that we're seeing this planet. That I shouldn't call it a planet. I don't know if I should do that or not, but
yeah,
I think it's a planet. So I'm going to call it a planet.
So you're pro-Pluto.
I'm pro-Pluto, yes. This is the first time we've really gotten to see the surface of Pluto, and this is going to change how we understand how the solar system formed. It's really quite amazing.
Right, and NASA has released a few photos of Pluto already, and I'm wondering, you know, is there anything interesting that you're seeing, anything that surprises you?
I don't think it looks anything like anyone expected it to look. I mean, I'm looking at the picture right now, and it doesn't have a lot of craters on the surface, and there looks like there's snow on the surface, and it's actually kind of colorful. It's got some orange and looks like some red and some dark spots, some places that look a little hilly. So this is not just a dead ball of rock floating around out there. And this has something going on the surface now. It's still a living place. It's a planet where there's things going on. It's not just sitting there. So that's kind of cool because we didn't expect that at all.
I think from images that we've gotten from the Hubble telescope, we've always thought of Pluto as this dead little rock at the edge of the solar system.
Yeah, a little dot on the telescope image, yes. I know we've taken pictures of Pluto as well with the Mount Cuba telescope, and that's a small telescope. It's about a quarter of the size of the Hubble Space Telescope. And when you take a picture of Pluto with that, all you can tell is it's a little speck of light. That's it. And you can see it move from one night to the next, so that's how you know it's a planet. It's something in the solar system. But with Hubble, I mean, Hubble's much bigger, and it's above the atmosphere. But it looks like a disk with Hubble. And maybe you can tell that there's darker spots on it.
Right.
But you can't see any detail. And it's because Pluto is 3 billion miles away. It's a huge distance. It's way out there on the edge of the solar system. So having New Horizons go fly by, we're going to be able to see details on the surface of that planet that we have not yet seen yet.
in your experience, you know, observing space, what sort of advantages do we have now that we have a probe observing an object as opposed to, you know, Hubble and the other telescopes that we have?
It's mostly the fact that the New Horizons got so close. It would be really wonderful if we could have Hubble orbiting Pluto. And then you could see boulder-sized things on the surface of Pluto. That would be amazing. But New Horizons got to within a few thousand miles of the surface. That's going to change everything that we think about what happened with Pluto and how it formed. And the moon, too. It has five moons. One is a pretty good-sized moon. It's called Charon. And I think the New Horizons is going to be getting some pretty good images of that as well. And so that's going to help us understand how the whole Pluto-Charon moon-planet thing formed in the first place.
Yeah. And, you know, what other sort of questions are you wondering about now that we have a probe that's out in the Kuiper Belt?
From what I was reading about New Horizons, it's powered by a nuclear generator, and it's supposed to be running until the year 2030 before it runs out of plutonium. So, and they're thinking about maybe redirecting it and sending it out to another one of these bodies that are out there. And I think that would be just amazing, too. Because I'm sure, like the planets in the inner solar system, I'm sure every single body that's out, you know, in the outer edges out there in the Kuiper Belt are different. They're not, and each one is going to show us something new.
Right. This is very unexplored territory that
to. And it's exciting because we've never seen this before.
Any chance that the Pluto planet or not planet case will be reopened this year?
I have heard whispers that it might be reopened.
Okay.
But whether it's actually going to happen or not, I don't know. You know, sometimes if you're trying to define an object with a scientific definition, sometimes people want to be really rigid about, you know, this is this and this is that. And sometimes you need to be a little bit more relaxed, I think. But we'll see. I think it deserves to be grandfathered in.
Our thanks to UD astronomer Judy Provenshaw and our own Eli Chen for their time this week. Next up on The Green, our arts playlist takes us to an exhibit in Wilmington comprised completely of paper. You're listening to Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Because books and greeting cards are two-dimensional, it might seem impossible for a page to add motion or depth other than through illustrations to add perspective and illusion. But for more than 700 years, artists and book designers have challenged boundaries. They have added flaps, revolving parts, and other movable pieces to enhance text. Nowadays, movable books and greeting cards are increasingly complex, with sophisticated pop-up illustrations and intricate mechanical devices. The paper engineer's task is to be both imaginative and practical, determining how movable pieces attach to the page so they won't break. Rob Kelly is up to that task. The Delawarean has worked as a paper engineer for over 10 years, mainly in the advertising world. But when he's not at his day job, Kelly designs paper-based pop-up sculpture and humorous greeting cards. This month, the Delaware Division of the Arts Mezzanine Gallery presents Kelly's new show, Midway, an exhibition that alludes to the space between science and art in which Kelly works, as well as the arcade influences from a carnival midway. In our arts playlist, Delaware Public Media's Kathy Carter gives us a preview of the exhibit.
Rob Kelly likes to say he's an all-around maker of things. He actually began practicing paper engineering and making kinetic sculptures since long before he knew such things existed. His earliest paper inventions were created out of a child's necessity and limited access to tools and materials.
When I was a boy, obviously no one would give power tools to a little kid, but I really wanted to make things. So my father was a contractor. We had plenty of tools, but I was not allowed to be using bandsaws. So I had scissors and tape, and I would make little springs out of paper. And I have all these little tiny things that I made. Before fifth grade, I remember my mother said I made a little waste basket out of paper completely. I mean, you step on the pedal and the lid lifted, and I made little jack-in-the-box things. And so I would make all these little things that moved completely out of paper, tape, and scissors. That was the kind of kid I was. I took my toy robots apart to find out what made them work. And I also used the little corners of tablets to make animation flip books, because motion is always sort of whatever is kinetic inspires me. So I love movement and to see why things move, how they move.
The intersection of art and science has always appealed to Kelly. He studied fine arts at UD and animation and 3D arts at the Delaware College of Art and Design. He's also a techie and has been granted several patents for his unique paper mechanisms, like the one on one of his pop-up Christmas cards.
I had the idea for several years of making a little train that goes around a tree, and but there wasn't a mechanism that I knew of in paper that would do that. So I shelved the idea, and I would go back to it, revisit it. Eventually, sort of the year that we had my son, I knew that this was I was going to resolve this, and I was going to make the little train because I had this idea in my head. So this is an invention that hadn't existed before now. So I had to make some pieces inside to manipulate the paper and to make it sort of conform to what I wanted it to do. It translates just linear motion into sort of a rotational motion, and it goes as far around in 360 degrees as I could get it to go in this small format. I tried several different things throughout that year and abandoned them, and then I guess just one night I thought about there's string inside of this, and string wraps around a hub, and I just thought, I wonder if that would work, and I tried it, and after more than 2 years of just playing with it and letting it go, it came together right away after that. I just had to make the specific part. So I bought a metal punch, and so I had to punch these parts and make what I needed.
Creating pop-up cards and paper sculpture reconciles both the artistic and technical sides that drive Kelly, and he says the twin inspirations are pretty evenly matched.
Sometimes I have a mechanical thought, like an idea, some mechanism to pursue, and then as I think about it, it sort of fills out in my head some little narrative or something I want to express with that mechanism. And other times for instance, with the train, I wanted to make a little train that went around, so I was seeking a mechanism that could satisfy that and had to end up creating one that I couldn't draw on something that had been done, so that was a case of invention. Sometimes that's necessary. Other times you see something or you can modify something you've done before or something you've seen, and so it could go either way. The mechanism, the technical, could precede the art or vice versa. Sometimes the concept drives the mechanism.
There are several other pop-up cards on display in Kelly's show. One is a freestanding ornament meant to be seen in the round of a coin-operated boardwalk arcade game with embellishments like ribbon and mirrors. It was another family Christmas card featuring his young son and wife, who helps Kelly put them together.
I remember her not being so thrilled about how many parts we had to glue onto this one. I kept adding parts. I really don't think too much about hand assembly when I do these cards. When I design for production, the price and difficulty comes to mind. But when I do these, I just let that go. And however difficult it is to assemble, that's how difficult it is. We make it work.
Elsewhere, there's a pop-up of a vintage pinball machine constructed using duplex paper that's red on one side and white on the other. It pops together in one motion by squeezing the sides.
This is made from a single piece of paper, so it's 40 inches long, and it just folds and glues to itself and becomes this sort of complicated freestanding pop-up piece. This was intended to be sort of self-promotional for myself, and in the gallery I have this version of this sort of deconstructed so that you can see sort of how it goes together. So at the end you see this, and at the beginning you see a long strip of paper.
Kelly designed the vintage paper pinball machine using a computer-aided design program, or CAD, which he was teaching himself to use at the time. It's software more typically used by architects and engineers.
I was teaching myself how to use a CAD program at the time, and this was sort of my lesson to myself. And I remember an experienced operator asked me why he was trying to do it in one piece, and because that's just harder than it needs to be. And I don't know, it just occurred to me one day that it would be a challenge to try to make something like this with a single piece. So it's one unbroken strip that just folds over and glues to itself. And additional challenge that I needed to help me learn, because as an artist, you're not trained to use technical like engineering software. And this was a way I could sort of learn that. And now I'm very acclimated to this CAD program. And I design these cards with sort of the specificity of a 64th of an inch sometimes. This can get much more accurate than we even need it to be. So some of the things I do are very mathematically complicated, and when it's finished, it's supposed to look easy and like it was just thrown together and lovely, but it can be a struggle, and I've learned to work with it, and it works with me, so it's a good relationship.
Beyond the pop-up cards are several intricate paper sculptures. Whitewood is a full-scale pinball playfield hung vertically on the wall.
And it's completely white, so it's undecorated, other than I think I'm playing with light here. I have different densities of paper and lights behind the paper. Some blink, some are steady, and that sort of provides the illustration that you come to expect on a pinball. But as you're looking at it from a distance, it's white on white, As you get up closer, you can see a lot of little doors, hidden ramps, stairs, things that are sort of improbable for a pinball. So, and I think of pinball as an allegory to different choices and directions, possibilities. The ball can go any different way. You have some influence on it with the flippers, but you're not in control. So it can take any path. And there's tiny little windows and doors, as I mentioned, corkscrew ramps, and sort of, I just like the idea of the pinball in that way, that it's sort of technical and artistic.
Kelly says his show at the Mezzanine Gallery is a big step in his career, and he's already looking ahead to his next challenge. Last year, he became a member of the Movable Book Society and attended the group's convention in Philadelphia last year.
I really have been wanting to make a book for a while, and just seeing the books there made me think this is really something I should do. I've done commercial art, I've done some greeting cards, done work for advertising, but I really haven't done a book yet, so I'm really excited about trying to do that now. I'm going to try to make a pop-up book, and I love the idea of like a longer form narrative, much more than just a one panel card. You could do much more with a book, and so many great things there that I've appreciated before, and new things I've seen in the book format that I'm excited to try that.
Our thanks to Rob Kelly for his time this week. His exhibition Midway is on view at the Delaware Division of the Arts Mezzanine Gallery in Wilmington through the end of the month. Stay with us. Enlighten Me is next with a look at the new Dover Police Cadet Program. This is Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on the green. I'm Tom Byrne. It's been about 2 months since the Dover Police Department sent its new police cadets onto downtown streets. The cadets are part-timers who are trained to give citations but not make arrests. Local merchants say the program has made the shopping district feel safer, and so far, concerns about how the cadets are armed haven't been realized. In this week's Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's Annie Ropeek returns. She followed two cadets as they walked their beat this week to get a first-hand look at how the program is working.
Just before 10 a.m. on a quiet, muggy morning in downtown Dover, local shops are opening their doors, and police cadets Logan Spicer and Lee Killam, ages 19 and 20, are on patrol.
You want to go brunch and lunch?
Yeah.
Spicer and Killam wear bright blue shirts with police cadets stamped on the back, radios on their shoulders, and tasers and pepper spray on their hips. They're two of six new cadets who've been out issuing citations and getting to know downtown merchants over the past several weeks. Inside the brunch and lunch on Lockerman Street, owner Dominic Williams jokes around with the cadets. His restaurant's only been open a couple of months, but he says he's already seen the program make a difference in the neighborhood.
Yeah, they come in all the time. They make sure we're all right. Sometimes people like to come sit in the seats, and they don't really come in and buy anything. If they're walking by, they'll come in, hey, these guys bothering you, and, you know, no, they're good.
The cadets mainly deal with people loitering, panhandling, drinking, or urinating in public. They can't make arrests, but they have been the first on scene for a handful of drug crimes. And while they went through the same psychological and physical evaluations and interviews they'd need to enter the full police force, Killam says not being fully fledged officers hasn't created major challenges.
You know, some people want to challenge you and challenge that you don't know the law, but we haven't had anything too serious. Most of it's just been they thought they knew the law better than we did. And it wasn't the case. They were actually wrong.
Killam, Spicer, and other cadets are hoping to apply to join the force full-time when they turn 21. The cadet program isn't required before the academy, but police department spokesman Mark Hoffman says it doesn't hurt to cultivate the next generation, especially since 30% of the force will soon be eligible for retirement.
We look at it as our farm team, basically. It gives us an idea of how they perform, gets them the experience they need, and it gives us an idea whether they can handle the full-time responsibilities of a police officer or not.
Dover's cadets get the same kind of training as seasonal officers in Delaware's beach towns. Rehoboth, for one, more than doubles its force in the summer. The seasonal hires work full-time hours and make misdemeanor arrests, but they only carry pepper spray, not tasers, like Dover's cadets. That was a sticking point for some before Dover's cadet program got off the ground. Delaware ACLU Director Kathleen McRae says they're still worried about entrusting what can be a deadly weapon to officers with less training. But she says they haven't had any complaints so far, and Spicer and Killam say the training they did receive left them feeling confident in the field.
We haven't been unprepared for any situation that we've encountered. They did a good job of preparing us.
But just like with Rehoboth's seasonal officers, the biggest role for Dover's cadets is public relations. The department is still mired in a civil rights lawsuit after an officer was caught on dash cam kicking a suspect in the face in 2013. Corporal Hoffman, the Dover spokesman, says their cadets are doing important work by talking with residents and being a face for the department downtown. Back on Lockerman Street, the cadets have stopped in Forney's jewelry store, where a chocolate lab named Stella is greeting them like old friends, panting and rolling around at their feet. Behind the counter, assistant manager Amy Macheska says the cadets do a good service.
Well, we have less complaints of people standing on the street, and everybody loves to have them around.
Plus, with the cadets on foot patrols, full-time officers can do more work in other neighborhoods. That's been especially necessary this year, with more homicides on the books since January than in all of 2014. The fifth and latest was on Monday, when 35-year-old Jamal Weeks was shot dead just east of downtown. The department is also still short more than a dozen full-time officers. Still, Corporal Hoffman says the cadets' impact should have a ripple effect throughout the city, statistically and otherwise.
By combating a lot of those little quality of life issues, you're going to push out a lot of the major issues as well. And ultimately, it's not about numbers, it's not about income or anything like that. It's about making people feel safe and being welcomed downtown again. And that's what we want to do, is create that friendly environment. You know, they can come down, they can say hello to the cadets, they can wave to them as they walk by, but ultimately they know that somebody's going to be there at all times and they don't have to worry about that stuff anymore.
The cadet program is grant funded for at least the next 2 years. Down the line, Hoffman says they hope to hire up to 12 cadets total and put some of them on bicycles, and they plan to ask the city for a code change to expand the cadets' patrol area to nearby housing projects. For Delaware Public Media, I'm Annie Ropeek in Dover.
Thanks, Annie, for enlightening us this week. And that's all for this week's edition of The Green. A reminder, the stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And you can now get The Green via podcast at our website and on iTunes, so check us out that way. We also value your feedback and story ideas, so contact us via our Facebook page, on Twitter, at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible. Delaware Public Media's Kathy Carter, Eli Chen, Annie Ropeek, as well as our station manager, Casey Houts. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.